It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickards.
And I'm Rob Farach. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, Attorney General nominee Loretta Lynch has waited 5 months, but her Senate confirmation vote is finally set, apparently, for tomorrow. We'll take our weekly look at Congress.
First, the state's Joint Finance Committee met today to talk about a couple of proposals affecting hunters, fishers, and anyone who uses the state's roads and highways.
On the table, possible increases to hunting and fishing fees, as well as the question of whether or not the DNR should keep its funding for the removal of dead deer from the state's roads and highways. This all comes among proposed cuts and layoffs to the agency, especially in its science bureau.
Joining us now to talk about the latest on these issues is Pat Durkin. He's an outdoor columnist for Wisconsin newspapers. Pat, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the issue of deer pickup. And until today, what was being considered?
The governor proposed eliminating the whole budget for paying private contractors to go around and pick up dead deer from the roads and highways. And it costs... The program costs about $700,000 a year. Half of it's paid by general taxpayer revenues and half's paid by hunting and fishing fees.
Now, to put this into perspective, how big a job is this?
Well, it varies, you know, because some counties are real fastidious about it. They get out there and anytime dead deer is found along the highway, they get it removed, and other counties aren't quite so aggressive about it. And sometimes you see the deer piled up there all winter, and then this time of year when the snow melts, you really see a lot of them pile up along the roads and in various stages of decay. So it can really vary, but typically, you know, each county is responsible, and they typically have a contractor or a number of contractors usually that go around and pick up the dead deer and get them off the road, or at least drag them down farther in the ditch and get them out of sight.
And ultimately, the JFC voted to restore that $700,000 in funding to the DNR. Why do you think they went that way?
I think it's one of these sensitivity issues, you know. I remember writing about this back in the 80s when it was proposed that, you know, like some states do, they just pretty much instruct their law enforcement people after a car deer collision to just pull the deer down the ditch and get it up. You know, as much out of sight as you can. And still that happens a lot in Wisconsin, too, where it's just easier than hauling a trailer down there and winching a dead deer aboard and hauling it away. And sometimes these deer are a mess, you know. They don't just die in one piece. And so it's kind of a gruesome thing for some people. And you know, one of the arguments, of course, is that when people are driving along Wisconsin highways, you know, they don't want to be viewing these scenes of carnage, you know, across the state.
Have there been problems in the past with turning that task over to local authorities, or at least the prospect of it, because it hasn't happened before? But do you see roadblocks there?
Yeah, I'm not sure there's ever been a real problem. It's mostly always, I think it comes back to how do you want to spend taxpayer dollars. And I think it's one of those things, though, people are sensitive to it, and if they're sensitive to it, they raise a ruckus because they don't want to be stuck with the responsibility themselves of hauling off a dead deer, even though, you know, today it's easier than ever for people, if they hit a deer, to claim the deer and take it home and cut it up themselves and eat it. You know, it's not that common. I think in one of the recent reports I saw, it's about 5% of the deer end up going home that way. People either who hit the deer themselves or someone happened to be driving by at the same time and they saw it and thought, hey, it's free meat, why not?
Right now we're talking with Outdoors columnist Patrick Durkin about potential changes to the DNR and a meeting with the Joint Finance Committee today on the budget. Today the panel wants the DNR to come up with a plan by 2017 to address an imbalance in the fund made up of hunting and fishing fees. What's the situation there?
Yeah, that was kind of interesting. And the governor didn't propose any kind of increases in license fees this year because, you know, I can't think when we last increased hunting and fishing license fees, but it wasn't, it was a few years now because it's been one of those touchy issues no one wants to talk about. But when you look at the states around us and what they charge for their hunting and fishing fees, you know, Wisconsin's gotten to where we're one of the lowest states right now, one of the better deals for hunting and fishing. So I guess I wasn't personally surprised by it. And this proposal I saw the other day was for basically an across-the-board $2 increase, which would raise about $2 million and save a lot of the quite a few of the positions they're talking about cutting. And when you just get down there and look at what else you pay, what other states pay, and what they charge for, especially non-resident fees, Wisconsin gives a pretty good bargain.
And do you think that's something, when we look at the prospects on fees, that looks the most likely raising the out-of-state fees for hunters and fishers?
Well, that's another one of those interesting topics that always comes up, because Wisconsin is a big tourism state, and Wisconsin, too, especially for deer hunting, where I do a lot of my work, the issue that comes up a lot is that families come home to deer hunt. And if they were raised in Wisconsin, they got used to paying a good, modest fee for a hunting license. They don't like to come home and pay a really steep non-resident fee. But our non-resident fee, the thing I point out, is that if you hunt in Iowa for deer right now, you're paying about $425 for either sex deer license. Wisconsin, you know, you're paying about $160. I think it's $160 right now. So it's Wisconsin, for as much good deer hunting as we have, we are really open to outside non-resident hunters. Other states aren't. They really, if you want to hunt in Iowa, you want to hunt in the western states, you're going to pay a lot of money to do it.
Now, this is something that was not in the governor's budget. Do we have any idea about the amount of revenue that could be generated by raising the fees?
I think the proposal I saw was, it looked like it was a straight across the board $2 increase. And I think their estimate came out, it's on this one report I was looking at this morning, I think their estimate came out to like $2.1 million extra that would raise, and just by raising, you know, each fee for each fishing license, each hunting license, because there's lots of different licenses for hunting and fishing and trapping in Wisconsin. So I think that was their best estimate, roughly $2.1 million.
Now, meanwhile, 57 DNR employees began receiving formal notices this week that they might face layoffs as part of the proposed cuts to the agency. 27 of those came for those working in the Bureau of Science Services, which is possibly facing some significant cuts. Is there worry that you know of from the outdoors community that these cuts could have a significant impact on how wildlife is managed here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of concern. I mean, you might not get it where people are... Where some of the rank and file guys and women are calling their legislators about it, but I think anyone who is aware of Wisconsin's heritage and our wildlife management systems, I mean, we are typically a state that the rest of the country envies for the resources we have, and we've always had this tremendous history for providing science sets. You know, going back in history, where we have really good records of deer numbers, fish population estimates. You know, one thing that the state agencies in Wisconsin has always done, better than our universities can't do, is they keep these year-to-year records that are vital to really making long-term decisions on the natural resources. So how many people are actually translating that kind of knowledge into phone calls to lawmakers because they're concerned, I have no idea. I really don't know how that's playing out. But I do know, I hear about it quite often from hunters and fishermen. They do know there's something at stake here. They might not use the information themselves, but they understand that there are people in decision-making positions who do look at that data.
Pat, thanks a lot for joining us.
You bet. Thank you.
That was Pat Durkin. He's an outdoors columnist for Wisconsin newspapers. It's our weekly look at Congress with USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer. After weeks of negotiations over abortion language and a sex trafficking bill, the Senate has come to an agreement. That clears the way for a confirmation vote on Attorney General nominee Loretta Lynch, who has been awaiting a vote for 5 months.
And a new book investigating corporate lobbying of Congress came to the conclusion that corporations spend more lobbying than taxpayers spend to fund Congress in its entirety. Here with us now is Paul Singer, joins us each Wednesday with the latest from Washington. Paul, good to have you back.
Hey, nice to be back. How you doing, Rob?
All right, well, good. So how did the Senate finally come to this agreement on this human trafficking bill?
Oh, man, these guys sometimes are just a hoot. You know, this is one of those things where somebody didn't do their homework, and the Republicans added to this legislation otherwise, you know, non-partisan, non-controversial, really, legislation on human trafficking to set up a restitution fund, basically. The Republicans stuck in a sentence that essentially says, as they like to do on some of these bills, that you can't use any of this money for an abortion. Well, You already can't use federal money for abortions. This is what we call the Hyde Amendment. So it was sort of unnecessary, but they keep trying to add it to legislation, and the Democrats keep shooting it down, and it becomes an argument. Well, the Democrats failed to read the bill and didn't notice this language until it was basically too late to do anything except block the entire bill for months while they tried to figure out some way around this mess. And in the end, they compromised on some language that I couldn't even begin to explain to you, that sort of slices out this piece of the pie and adds to that piece of the pie and says, not here, but then there, and everybody walks away, you know, more or less feeling they've won something. But really, if someone had read the bill 5 months ago, this wouldn't have been a problem.
And ultimately, this is a bill, the main part of it is something that everybody, there's bipartisan agreement. They all wanted this thing, mostly.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But, you know, this is part of what I teach my students, is that, you know, you got to read the bill, because everybody wants to hang their little ornament on whatever Christmas tree is moving most quickly. This was the one that everybody wanted to move, so somebody hung an ornament on it, and nobody noticed. And then they had to spend a bunch of time unpacking and figuring out how to get the ornament off it.
Well, here's something you can teach me. Why did the delay on this bill have something to do with a delayed vote on a confirmation of the new attorney general?
I don't think it really did. The Senate Majority Leader said he was not going to bring up the vote on Loretta Lynch until we resolve this problem, because if we can't do these sort of simple bipartisan things, then what's the point? Now, of course, there was nothing really stopping him from bringing up the Loretta Lynch nomination any time in the meanwhile. He just sort of set down that marker. And I really think they were just sort of, you know, it was an opportunity to delay a vote they didn't want to have anyhow. So now they'll get this out of the way, and then they'll go ahead and have the vote. And, you know, there's some argument that over the time that they've been waiting, the support for Loretta Lynch has waned in the Senate, which just makes it a less celebratory moment for her, and possibly another reason to raise eyebrows, because she will pass with a smaller margin.
Is it long, normal to have this long a wait for a confirmation of a cabinet member?
No, it usually moves pretty quickly, unless there's something extraordinarily controversial about the cabinet member. And again, in this case, when they first nominated Lynch, the general discussion was, she'll have a lot of support. You know, even Republicans say that she's qualified, and, you know, that what they don't like about her is that she's too close to Barack Obama and not sufficiently distant from Eric Holder. And all of the arguments about Loretta Lynch are really arguments about Barack Obama and Eric Holder, but that sooner or later they'd probably just give up and let her go ahead and pass. But no, it doesn't usually take this long.
And you said the margin of support may not be as great, but you think that she has the votes to be confirmed this week?
I think so. Yeah. I haven't been tracking it, you know, particularly carefully, but you know, my impression has been that she had the votes to be confirmed, but the number has been getting smaller over the past couple of months while this has been hanging out there, and people have had more opportunity to pressure senators to say no.
Talking to USA Today's Paul Singer about the news out this week in Congress. Now, a new book getting some attention on the influence of lobbying in Congress. The book's called The Business of America is Lobbying by Lee Drutman. Makes the case that as of last year, at $2.6 billion a year, corporations spend more money lobbying Congress than we taxpayers spend funding Congress altogether. I know you track money in politics, its influence. Is this a surprising number? Is this an alarming number, do you think?
No, you know, I'm not sure that's a bad thing. If the whole point is that corporations are willing to spend a lot of money to try and influence the workings of Congress, Congress is not going to grow. In fact, Congress, the budgets for Congress over the past several years have been shrinking a little bit, in the House fairly significantly, in the Senate a little bit, down, I think the last number was down something like 10 or 11% over the past few years. So, you know, Congress isn't going to grow, but businesses and more businesses will compete more for scarce resources, and they'll spend more competing for them. And, you know, the whole point is that lobbying is a private venture. They can spend as much as they want. Congress is a public venture. It has to maintain its costs. So I wouldn't be too surprised that people spend more on lobbying than Congress spends on itself. I'd be more surprised if Congress spends more. Government industries spend more on lobbying than Congress spends on, you know, federal agency of some sort. That would be sort of interesting.
How much effect does the lobbying money from corporations have on what Congress actually does? Are they throwing their money away here, or does it make a difference?
Oh, no, I'm sure it makes a huge difference. I mean, the people have these very cartoonish views of what lobbyists do, but in general, the whole purpose of lobbying is if someone is going to propose new legislation to regulate, oh, I don't know, public radio stations, you guys would have somebody on staff paid to go talk to Congress to say, well, if you're going to regulate public radio stations, here's what you shouldn't do, because you'll shut us down. The idea of the lobbyist in that case is to provide information to the Congress about legislation and the impact of legislation that they're about to consider. Like, there's nothing nefarious about that, necessarily. Now, where people get concerned is when lobbyists and lobbying firms can spend an enormous amount of money basically deluging members of Congress with information, hiring their staff or the revolving door. They can hire members who've left Congress to go back and lobby, and using all that influence to sort of unfairly balance the scales in their favor. That's harder to measure. But in many of these things, it's corporate interest against corporate interest, spy versus spy, as we would say. So, yeah, they outspend each other.
Well, speaking of spying, you in a recent piece gave us a little insider's take on the Washington Correspondents' Dinner, and I want to spend a little time with you on that. You're planning to attend Nerd Prom. Is that the phrase that you and others have used to describe this thing?
Yeah, in fact, there's actually a video, a new documentary out this year called Nerd Prom by a reporter here in D.C. who used to have to cover it. He used to cover the sort of party scene, and he's calling the movie Nerd Prom. That's what they refer to it. It's kind of the joke. There's a White House Correspondents Association has this annual dinner. You know, and it used to be a bunch of reporters get together and they, you know, give out their reporter awards, and some of the politicians come, and that's great. And in the mid-1980s, I guess it was, somebody invited, I think it was Fawn Hall, who was like Oliver North's secretary or something. And then it just all went downhill from there. They started, you know, every celebrity and every news organization wanted to get the biggest celebrity, and Lindsay Lohan has been there, and, you know, the cast of House of Cards was there, I guess, last year, the year before. I mean, just, it has become, there's actually a red carpet now where all the celebrities go walk and get their pictures taken. But, you know, what I wrote in my column is that underneath this, it's still just a trade association dinner. You know, it's a bunch of reporters who get together, and we haven't seen each other all year, and we drink together, and we applaud at the awards that are being given to our colleagues. You know, no big deal.
But you write that you have felt anxiety in the past, other journalists, about the optics, as they say in the political world, the ethics of the event. Why is that?
There's two issues involved. The first issue involved is that we all invite members of Congress to be our guests at these dinners. And so there's this question of, should we be that cozy with a member of Congress that we invite them to be our guest at a lavish dinner? There's an ethics question on both sides, right? I mean, A, should the member of Congress accept a lavish dinner? And B, should we be inviting members of Congress to socialize with us? The bigger problem is outside the dinner itself. When you get into the parties that go on, there are these, everybody's trying to throw these lavish affairs where members of Congress and political types and Hollywood stars and reporters can all, you know, sort of dance the night away in these very luxurious events with gift bags and stuff. And it just raises this whole question about, have we lost touch with the American people as reporters if we think it is appropriate to go, you know, hang out and get drunk with politicians at some high-dollar affair where everybody's wearing a tuxedo? It reminds the rest of the world that we are not among them. We are part of the celebrity class. And there is a real sensitivity to that. I think all of us who cover government officials for a living need to be very cautious about not becoming captured by our prey. And thinking that, oh, well, they're nice people, I've partied with them, therefore they couldn't be doing anything wrong. Fact of the matter is, they could be, and the fact that you're drinking with them tonight should not in any way, shape, or form stop you from writing a critical story about them tomorrow.
So you've come to terms with it? You could still write that critical story about them tomorrow, even though you overcooked chicken with them the night before?
Yeah. In fact, 1 year, I think I mentioned this in the column, I was sitting at a table with this congressman who was complaining about the fact that, you know, reporters were investigating his personal finances. I was one of the reporters. Like, it sort of, it didn't dawn on him exactly who I was, and I had been doing some investigations. So, yeah, I got no problem being nice to you today and then calling you tomorrow and say, hey, look, it was really a pleasure, and I really enjoyed our conversation, and I really am interested in your tax return and how come this dollar figure is too high.
Well, it has been a pleasure having this conversation, Paul. I think we'll bring Veronica back on mic now. This is your last day as a regular guest discussing Congress. You've been with us every Wednesday pretty much since January of last year. A lot of great insight, a lot of laughs. Thanks a lot for all the time you've spent with us over the last year plus,
Paul.
Yeah,
it has been a pleasure hanging out with you on Wednesdays, learning stuff, kicking the ball around, talking Congress. And we hope that you'll miss us as much as we're going to miss you.
It has been absolutely my joy to do it. I appreciate you guys inviting me, and I certainly hope that it's not the last time we have a conversation just because I'm not going to be your regular 4 o'clock Wednesday phone call or 3 o'clock your time.
Yeah, and you're going to be doing some investigative reporting, so you will come back and talk about some of your investigative reports.
Yeah, the money and the politics stuff is a lot of what I'm doing, so I'm sure we'll keep in touch.
All right, looking forward to it. Paul, really, thanks a lot. It's been a blast.
Thanks, guys. Talk to you soon.
That was USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer. He joined us virtually every Wednesday since January 2014 with the latest on Congress. Today, as we said, is last day as a Wednesday regular. We'll miss him, but we'll see him again.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. The latest Wisconsin survey from WPR, WPT, and St. Norbert College is out as of this morning. The survey looks at policy, politics, the economy, and more. Right now, we'll focus in on what the survey had to say about Governor Walker, Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish, and some recent out-of-state travel that the governor has done.
Wendy Scattergood joins us now to talk about the results. She's Assistant Professor of Political Science at the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute. Wendy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start by looking at Governor Walker's approval rating here in Wisconsin. First of all, what specifically did you ask people?
We asked people just basically whether they approved or disapproved of the job that the governor was doing. And 41% say they approve, and 58% said that they disapprove.
How does this compare to where he was last year in the spring and in the fall?
When we asked this in the fall of 14, he was at 48%. So there has been a drop. And compared to last year, we were looking at 59%. So just an overall sort of slide since the election, which is it's pretty typical. I mean, it's a pretty big slide at this point, which may not be as typical, but we would see both governors and presidents as they sort of start at a high after an election and then kind of slide through until the fourth year, and then usually you see a bump up a little bit.
Now, you started looking at the governor asking this question in spring of 2011. Since then, what have some of the peaks and the valleys been?
Basically, what we find, and this is very obviously very partisan, nobody's going to be surprised by that, and what we generally find is that over time, that Republicans will sort of rally both when the recall election was happening and then again as we moved into a little bit into the 2014 election, and then you see it dip in those non-election times. The other thing that's important there is that a lot of those samples that we do just before elections are likely voters, whereas this time it's Wisconsin residents as a whole.
So how does that affect things?
Well, those folks are going to be more partisan, the people who are getting ready to vote, the likely voters. And so you would likely see then a more polarized answers during those times, and as well as particularly among Republicans, of course, are going to have stronger favorability.
When we talk about trends over these last years, is it fair to say that over the years you have seen trends, or perhaps that the governor is in one right now?
Yeah, I think so, and we're definitely seeing this trend downward. And as I said, that's pretty typical both for presidents and for governors to see that kind of it. It's pretty big, but of course we were also in the field right after the budget proposal came out, and that was reflected in a lot of the different variables that we saw, particularly among the what do you think is the biggest problem facing the state?
And do you know how this breaks down among different demographic groups here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so when we look at sort of partisan identification, 34% were Democrats and 35% were Republicans. Then among the independents, 10% lean Democrat, 11% are straight independent, and then 5% lean Republican.
And what does this tell you overall as you look at a big year for the governor? He looks likely to announce for president. What does this tell you big picture about what he is, where he is right now?
Well, it tells us where he is in Wisconsin, first of all, so we have to be careful about that because, of course, he's going to be running on a national stage, which is going to be quite different than what's going on here. But with low approval ratings, when we have the majority saying that they don't think that he should run, I think, and that he wouldn't make a very good president, I think those are indicative. But, of course, again, they're very partisan. So the people in the Republicans and the people who lean Republican are supportive of him, and they think he should run, although some of the Republicans don't think he should run, and that may be because they think he should stay here and run the state.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is there any sort of correlation that you're aware of between attitudes toward a politician, particularly a governor, in a state and national perception?
Yeah, definitely. When we asked the strengths and weaknesses as a president among the Walker supporters, you know, they're definitely looking at some of his weaknesses as being he doesn't really have the foreign affairs experience. Obviously, he's been traveling abroad recently, but that's still, at least among the Wisconsin Republicans, as being perceived as is his greatest weakness. On the other hand, they think his strength is really in his message and that he sticks to what he says he's going to do, and that particularly his ability with the budget. And if people are focused on domestic issues and the deficit, then that's going to help him.
We're talking right now about the results from the latest Wisconsin survey just out this morning with Wendy Scattergood, assistant professor of political science at the St. Norbert College Strategic Institute. And we're going to look at some other parts of the survey right now. We're going to look at the question about Governor Walker's recent out-of-state travel, things like speech giving, maybe as part of the prelude to a presidential campaign. First off, what did that question say?
We asked people whether they thought that his traveling to a number of other states to give speeches and meet with potential supporters for a possible presidential campaign, and whether they saw those trips as beneficial to Wisconsin, had no effect on, or were detrimental. And the plurality, the most cited, was 43% said that they felt it was detrimental, 36% said that it had no effect on, and 18% said that it was beneficial. So obviously the Democrats and the Democratic leaners and the independents were much more likely to say that they thought it was detrimental, whereas Republicans were much more likely to say it has no effect on them.
Is there a percentage point at which you say, okay, that is a strong response or that is not? What sort of margins are you looking at for that?
Well, the response, the error rate for the survey is plus or minus 4%, so that's one of the things we look at. And then when I'm running this, particularly when I'm running it against the partisan identification, there's actually a statistical test called a chi-square, which tells me whether the differences between the parties on their answers to these different questions is statistically significant, which means can we say, while there might be a difference in the survey itself, can we generalize that difference to the people of Wisconsin more generally? So if it's statistically significant, then we can say, yes, we can generalize that difference.
And in terms of these results, is it statistically significant?
Yeah.
So you said 43% are finding it detrimental at this point. And do you have any clue beyond that, or is that as far as the survey takes us?
That's really all we asked on that particular question. But, you know, when you look at it in the context of, you know, when we asked people whether they thought that he would make a good president, and whether they, you know, favor or opposed him running. So 59% said that they opposed him running. On looking at whether he would be a good, excellent, good, not so good, or poor president, 39% said that it'd be excellent or good, and 60% said not so good or poor. Again, that's pretty partisan. So what's interesting, of course, are the independents, and that's what makes a difference. And the independents are pretty anti-Walker at this point.
Now, Wendy, a lot of the questions you ask over and over again over the years. This one, for instance, pretty unprecedented, having a governor who's running for president. Is there anything else that you can compare this to in history or by a state-by-state basis?
Well, not for Wisconsin, from when we've been polling, which is since the mid-1980s, so we don't really have any data from there. We did ask about, I think when I first started, we were talking about Tommy Thompson because he was about to be potential for him to be appointed. So we were asking some of those kinds of questions. But I think it's important to remember that Tommy Thompson at the time was much more popular as a governor.
What does popularity look like as a governor when you're looking at the statistics?
It really, really varies, and that's true from state to state, that we are in a time now that's pretty cynical, so a lot of the governors are suffering from those kinds of things. And as I said, there's a typical pattern that they start out pretty high, and then they sort of drop, typically also in their second term administration, that it tends to be lower than their first administration. So we would find that for a Democratic president in Obama, which we are seeing, as well as for Republicans.
We'll take a call now. We've got Jane joining us in Green Bay. Jane, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I'm calling because I'm angry that Scott Walker is not declaring himself as a president, as a candidate for president. And because he is not doing that, the taxpayers are paying for his travels. And if he was so concerned about budget, he would be using campaign funds and be open, I am going to run for president, or I am running for president.
Okay, thank you, Jane. And Jane, in a certain responding category of the survey, do you think that response is typical of the people who saw this as detrimental, Wendy?
It's hard to say. I think when we look at the biggest problem, I think people are more focused on the actual issues rather than campaign spending versus tax money. I think part of which is because when he's traveling abroad, first of all, he's on trade missions for, you know, that a lot of times are paid for by the businesses in Wisconsin. Also that there are other funds being used when he's out of the state giving and raising money, that he's not using taxpayer funds for that. So, I mean, I think there's a question of, you know, when he's abroad, he's working with Wisconsin businesses to try to, you know, increase the exports from Wisconsin. So the question is that an investment, or is it really just a veil for campaigning? And, you know, people are going to differ depending on their view of Walker on that.
We're talking about the results from the Wisconsin survey from WPR, WPT, and St. Norbert College just out this morning. We're talking with Wendy Scattergood, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute.
And we want to hear from you on this. How would you rate your approval of Governor Walker today? How do you feel about his out-of-state travel as part of a possible presidential bid? And do you have an opinion about the kind of job Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish would do as governor if Scott Walker leaves that office for Washington? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about the results from the Wisconsin survey from WPR, WPT, and St. Norbert College, hot off the presses this morning. And we're talking with Wendy Scattergood, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute.
We want to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. As Wendy Scattergood has noted, Governor Walker's approval has dropped some since last year, since before the elections. Fairly normal pattern, she says, for a governor, but maybe a larger slide than we'd usually see, in part maybe because of the budget. What do you chalk up that slide in approval rating to? What do you think? What do you think the governor is doing right? What do you think he's doing wrong here in Wisconsin? How do you feel about out-of-state travel, maybe leading up to a presidential bid? And what would you think about Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish stepping into the governor's job should Governor Walker head to Washington? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also share your thoughts, see a little bit of the data over at the Central Time Facebook page.
And Wendy, we're going to pick up with Lieutenant Governor Clayfish right now. One of your questions regards her. The question, if Scott Walker should win the presidency in 2016, do you think Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish would make an excellent, good, not so good, or poor governor of Wisconsin? What do people say?
First of all, just over a fifth weren't sure. So, and that was standard and steady over the different partisan identifications. So Democrats and Republicans were about the same, saying they weren't sure. So that's the first thing. Second, there's some big partisan differences. So overall, we find that 9% said that she would be excellent, 34% think that she'd be good, 12% not so good, and 25% poor. But when we look at the partisan differences, for example, among Republicans, 70% think that she would be excellent or good, compared to only 21% saying that for the Democrats.
Do you ever pull on what people think of the lieutenant governor in normal circumstances?
Typically not.
So this was a new one. So we don't really know if it's if that not sure number, that 22%, is typical or not.
Yeah, we don't really have anything to compare it with. Except that we know that it actually is pretty high for the approval ratings for Senators Johnson and Baldwin. So, for example, Senator Johnson, when we did his approval rating, 26% said they didn't know.
We're going to go to our phones now. We've got a caller here. Dave is next in Kimberly. Hi, Dave.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a comment about Walker, and he is really showing what an idiot he is when he's running for president, and he did get away with this running for governor, but from what I understand, he was thrown out of Marquette University for corruption.
I'm going to jump in, Dave, make sure we stay more focused on the survey. But, you know, Dave is reflecting the partisan breakdown of politics in Wisconsin right now, a very strong partisan feeling. Was that reflected, do you think? Do you see that in these numbers, Wendy?
When we asked what they felt the greatest weakness was, and this was an open-ended question, so people could just say whatever they wanted, and kind of across the board, there were a few people for every partisan identification that said his lack of a college degree was, in fact, a weakness of his. But that was true of Democrats and Republicans.
All right. Well, thank you, Dave. We're going to go next to Caroline in La Crosse. Caroline, hi.
Hi. The reason Walker may not be establishing that he's running is because while he is not officially a candidate, he can collect all the money he wants, and once he declares, then he's going to have to start telling where his money's coming from.
Okay, thank you for that, Wendy.
It takes a lot of money to run for president, and if you're going to make a run for it, you better make sure that you're a viable candidate, because that's a huge investment of time, energy, family included, that, you know, they have to be sure that it's the right thing for them to do.
Okay, appreciate that call. You can join us at 800-642-1234. As we talk with Wendy Scattergood, assistant professor of political science at the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute, talking about the latest Wisconsin survey results. They're just out this morning. And we're going to go next to Victor, joining us in Oconomowoc. Hi, Victor.
Hi, good afternoon. I think Governor Walker has been an absolute disaster. If he had applied Act 10 to every union, he could have at least claimed policy consistency, but by exempting fire and police, it was obvious he was targeting Democratic constituencies, a purely political move. He turned down funds from the Fed that could have stimulated our economy. The line between Milwaukee and Madison was one of the best possible sites for high-speed rail. He's turning down the Medicaid expansion. And I think that if Rebecca Clayfish was elevated to the governor's office, what a gift to the Democrats. She is such a chucklehead.
Victor, thanks for the call. Just to focus in on unions, Wendy, that is something you ask people's attitudes about. It's been a big subject here in Wisconsin. How much did people care about or respond to what's happening with unions in Wisconsin on the survey?
And this time where it came out was in what do you think the biggest problem facing the state is, and that came out as our number 8 most cited issue. And it was divided between people thinking that breaking up the unions, and particularly right now it's the right to work issue, versus people's the other part of the people thinking that unions are actually the problem. In the past, we have seen people on that same question talk about Act 10 as being the biggest problem facing the state, et cetera. When we asked people about his presidential bid, that was definitely something that came up. And, of course, it's very partisan there, that supporters see that as a strength of his, whereas those who are not his supporters think that that's extremely problematic.
Well, thank you for that call. And we go next to Eric joining us in Janesville. Eric, hi.
Hi. I'll be quick. I have two quick questions. One is, how often do you do this polling? And if you could do something like this day to day, how much of a change would you see based on, say, a news announcement or whatever? Is it, in other words, what kind of number jump should we see before we think it's a big deal?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. First of all, we do the survey twice a year. We do it in the spring and the fall. You know, as I was saying a little bit earlier, where when we're talking about the slide in the governor's approval rating, one of the things that we're looking at is the timing of when it happened. And certainly we have to look at if something happens in the news while we're in the field, that could change people's opinions. So, for example, when the federal government shutdown happened, that actually happened in the middle of our survey. And so what we did there was we had the dates when each of the responses came in so that I actually could compare the answers for those that answered the questions prior to the shutdown and those that did it afterwards. And so we could see there actually wasn't, in that case, there actually wasn't that much difference in people's assessment, both in approval ratings, biggest problem, national economy, congressional approval rating, et cetera. Surprisingly, you'd think there would be a change, right? But there really wasn't that big of a difference.
And we have to leave it there. We're out of time. Wendy, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure.
We've been speaking with Wendy Scattergood, assistant professor of political science at the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute. We're talking about the results from the latest Wisconsin survey from WPR, WPT, and St. Norbert College.
We'll pick up the conversation tomorrow on Central Time. The survey also asked people what they think about the state's economic well-being and future prospects. A guest weighs in on the perception and reality of Wisconsin's economy.
Today is Earth Day, and it's the 45th anniversary of the environmental event here in the United States.
The day has a strong Wisconsin connection with Gaylord Nelson, generally credited as the founder of the event, a U.S. senator at the time. Nelson had also been a governor of Wisconsin previously. By the time of that first Earth Day in 1970, he'd been working on environmental issues for years, including persuading President John F. Kennedy to go on a conservation speaking tour in 1963.
Here's a bit of a speech by Senator Gaylord Nelson in 1970 on the eve of the very first Earth Day. This is from Milwaukee Public Television by the website NelsonEarthDay.net. Here he is talking about his concept of ecology.
It is concerned with the habitat of marine creatures, animals, birds, and man. And our goal is not just an environment of clean air and water and scenic beauty while forgetting about the worst environments in America, in the ghettos, in Appalachians, and elsewhere. Our goal is an environment of decency, quality, and mutual respect for all human beings and all other living creatures.
That was Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson, founder of Earth Day on the eve of the first Earth Day, 45 years ago today.